From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe says the Justice Department considered bringing Trump cabinet members together to consider removing the president from office. McCabe claims the move was proposed after Trump fired FBI Director Jim Comey. The Justice Department is denying McCabe's claim. We'll have the latest right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wow, what big news from Amazon this morning. All those cities like Los Angeles competing to get Amazon's second headquarters, New York winning, along with the area outside Virginia getting some expansion there, and then only to have Amazon pull the plug on the New York City project just about an hour or so ago. We'll talk about that in our second hour on Air Talk right here on 89.3. Coming up this hour, California's new law mandating disclosure of police disciplinary files. Does the law apply retroactively? Officers unions say no, claiming many officers didn't bother fighting disciplinary action, knowing the allegations against them wouldn't be made public. News organizations, including KPCC and the ACLU, they argue the new law applies to past disciplinary action. We'll get to that later this hour. But first, a CBS 60 Minutes interview of former FBI Director Andrew McCabe delivered a bombshell. McCabe claimed that the Department of Justice considered bringing together Trump cabinet members who would look at whether the president should be removed from office. And McCabe also talked about his efforts to assure that the Mueller investigation would continue after Jim Comey was removed.
I met with the team investigating the Russia cases, and I asked the team to go back and conduct an assessment to determine where are we with these efforts and what steps do we need to take going forward. I was very concerned that I was able to put the Russia case on absolutely solid ground in an indelible fashion, that were I removed quickly or reassigned or fired, that the case could not be closed or vanish in the night without a trace. I wanted to make sure that our case was on solid ground, and if somebody came in behind me and closed it and tried to walk away from it, they would not be able to do that without creating a record of why they'd made that decision.
You wanted a documentary record.
That's right.
That those investigations had begun because you feared that they would be made to go away.
That's exactly right.
That conversation from the 60 Minutes interview, Scott Pelley, with former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. The longer interview will be on 60 Minutes this coming Sunday night. But the real controversy over McCabe's claim, which has since been denied by the Department of Justice, that the department was considering bringing together members of the president's cabinet to determine whether he should be removed from office using the 25th Amendment to the Constitution. With us is Loyola Law professor and former federal prosecutor Lori Levinson. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Good to be with you, Larry.
Are you concerned about if McCabe's claim is accurate, that the Department of Justice would consider bringing cabinet members together for this purpose?
Well, it's certainly something we haven't seen before. And it wonders, you know, how seriously they were really taking the firing of Comey, how much they felt like the political process might be corrupted. I have my concerns, because ordinarily what law enforcement does is investigate, and it sounded like here he was worried that the investigation would be shut down. But the 25th Amendment, in my mind, is something that's more part of the political process than the Department of Justice process.
Do you have any sense of how to reconcile McCabe's claim and then the statement from the Department of Justice denying that this was ever under consideration? Any way to square that?
I think actually it can be squared, and often the truth is somewhere in between. It may be very well that McCabe was very concerned, especially after talking to Comey, and he started to talk to other people in the department, including the lawyers for the department, and people were banting around ideas like the 25th Amendment, and he took that seriously, and other people said, well, let's just let the investigation go on. They might not have been as concerned as he was, or certainly didn't think of the type of investigative techniques he was suggesting, like having someone wear a wire around the president.
And do you think that that would be appropriate in a case like this for a member of the Department of Justice, whether it's Rod Rosenstein, the deputy AG, or anyone else, to wear a wire? Could that be defended as important to the investigation?
You know, that is so hard to say. Again, we haven't seen anything like that before. It's the type of investigation the FBI does. I think that what's good here is that they ended up not having to do any of that because you had an independent counsel, Robert Mueller, who took over the investigation. I actually think that this points out how critically important Mueller's investigation became. So you didn't have the FBI saying, gee, how are we going to treat this case? Do we treat it like all the other cases we investigate?
What's your understanding as to the 25th Amendment's application and what the role of Congress would have to be in removing the president?
Well, the 25th Amendment is put in when the president's no longer able to perform his duties. Sometimes it's because he's ill or under anesthesia, but this would be a time where they'd say that he would be no longer able to perform his duties. You could use a majority of the cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment, and then the vice president becomes the president. Or if you can't do that, you can get the majority over on the legislative side to do it as well. I think either one of those would have been extremely difficult, given the Republicans being in control of all the branches of the government.
President Trump has, throughout the course of his presidency, talked about a deep state, the idea that there are entrenched employees of the federal government who have their own agenda and exercise their power independent of the executive branch or any other branch. Your thoughts as to whether, again, if McCabe's claim is accurate, that this, in a sense, reinforces the notion of a branch of the federal government acting in a way that's not just unilateral but unauthorized.
Well, I'm sure that Trump will say these were the renegades. They thought they had more power than they did. On the other hand, I step back and ask, if they sincerely believed that this was a president who had corrupted everybody in the system and had the power to shut it all down, how are they going to make sure that doesn't happen? And as you pointed out, how do you get a record of what's happening? There's no game plan for this. You know, we haven't seen this before. And this might not have been appropriate. In the end, nobody did anything on the 25th Amendment. But the fact that they were banting it about probably just said, we're taking this very seriously.
Professor, before I let you go, just anything to add that you think we should consider in the wake of this claim?
Well, I think we should consider the fact that we're still hearing from insiders. You know, McCabe was an insider. And that there's been spin all along about what was happening with the Comey firing. We don't have Mueller's report on it yet, but from those who worked in the department, they didn't see it as just Trump, you know, talking over dinner, throwing out some ideas, and then firing the head of the FBI. They saw it as an assault on their department.
Professor, thank you as always. Appreciate your being with us.
My pleasure.
Lori Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and former federal prosecutor, also with us from John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, lecturer there and former special agent and assistant legal advisor for the FBI in the mid-1980s, David M. Shapiro. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
You're welcome.
Your response to the claim, at least, that we have from Mr. McCabe.
Well, it's so difficult to assess these, and I hate to play this. He said, she said. I mean, everybody is waiting for evidence. And, I mean, it's long past time that people get evidence and that this gets aired in a more transparent way. Because, you know, obviously McCabe said one thing and the Department of Justice now has said something else. So, you know, what does that mean? I'm not so sure that we split the difference. Sometimes people lie and sometimes people don't. But certainly we're not going to resolve that by just watching 60 Minutes.
If the claim is accurate, if there is evidence substantiating the claim of Mr. McCabe, do you think that that would have been a justifiable action by the FBI or Department of Justice?
Well, of course. I don't, that anybody would even suggest that anybody in this country, especially inside the government at high, and at high levels, is above the law is a legal absurdity. So I think that that would have been a proper course of conduct. Investigations get squashed to high levels in I don't want to say all the time, but it's certainly not something that no one has ever seen before. So, we have to take it seriously.
All right. And you think even to the point where an investigator might wear or a member of the FBI or the Justice Department might wear a wire, record the president, that could be justified?
Well, it could be justified so long as the process was adhered to. There are processes and rules in place to determine when one can wear a wire and record somebody else surreptitiously. But, so that needs to be followed through. If you're asking me whether those circumstances could have existed to justify such wearing a wire, of course they could have. I mean, nobody is above the law and nobody is allowed to commit crimes and then hide them with nanny-nanny poo-poo. I'm above the law. You can't get the evidence. So it didn't happen, right?
We're talking with David Shapiro, Jan Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Also with us from Radford University in Virginia, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice Luke Hunt, also author of the forthcoming book, The Retrieval of Liberalism in Policing. He's a former FBI special agent and supervisory special agent for 7 years. Mr. Hunt, thank you for joining us. Your thoughts on what Andrew McCabe is alleging here?
Yeah, I see this in a sense as an example of officials not staying in their lane, so to speak. As your first guest noted, we typically think of the cabinet as having the duty to determine whether the president should be removed under the 25th Amendment due to some sort of incapacitation. Now, on the other hand, the FBI's duty is to protect the Constitution and to enforce federal law. Now, an important point to make, though, is that Article 2 of the Constitution requires that the president take care that the laws are enforced faithfully. So if we were to, sort of look at McCabe's actions charitably, you might say that he perceived the president as failing to fulfill that duty. In other words, not acting faithfully, because you can't act faithfully if you're obstructing justice. So I think the upshot, though, is his response to that is perhaps or perhaps could have been misguided. In other words, there may have been other options rather than to sort of solicit or recruit members of the cabinet to sort of fulfill their duty, which they already had anyway, independent of McCabe.
And in a case like this, what is there any way it would be appropriate, short of investigation results being presented to Congress, for the Department of Justice to go directly to cabinet members to say, hey, maybe you should look into removing the president? He's not acting in a way that enables him to exercise the responsibilities of the office.
I think that's a great question. And one point I want to be clear about, I certainly agree with your second guest that no one's above the law. Certainly that would include the president. But we do get into these very difficult constitutional questions that we've all heard about recently, about whether the president can, or a sitting president can be indicted, can be investigated and go to a criminal court while acting as president. And a lot of people tend to say, and I think this is the position of the Department of Justice, that those things don't happen during a presidency because it prevents the president from fulfilling his duty. Now, it may happen post-presidency. So I think the typical recourse would be to rely on the political process. In other words, the impeachment process to remove the president rather than sort of the criminal process. Now, that being said, if there is evidence of crime breaking. There's no doubt that the FBI would follow up on that. The question is when that would be appropriate to move forward and who that would be handed off to, and you know when it would be an opportune time to do that.
If McCabe's contention is corroborated,
right.
Does this damage the reputation of the FBI or the Department of Justice or not?
You know, I think there is a problem of optics, and the main problem is this, that we have a president who has a very loud megaphone and can voice these, you know, very inflammatory statements about the FBI via Twitter and so on. And a lot of times those statements are completely unfounded and they're not grounded in fact, right? So I think there is the potential for damage there. Now, on the other hand, I do agree, again, going back to your first guess, that there's a very strong likelihood, and it seems probably true, that the FBI was seriously concerned about the nature of the president's actions. In other words, if he is firing the director as a way to shut down the Russian investigation, that's a clear motive for obstruction of justice, and there has to be some kind of strong response to that. And in that sense, I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of about taking some sort of appropriate action.
I want to thank you for being with us. That's Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice at Radford University in Virginia, Luke Hunt, former FBI Special Agent and Supervisory Special Agent for 7 years. His forthcoming book, The Retrieval of Liberalism in Policing. My thanks to John Jay College of Criminal Justice lecturer David M. Shapiro, who was Assistant Legal Advisor to the FBI in the 1980s and a former Special Agent for the Bureau. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll talk about the new California law on investigations into law enforcement officer misconduct. Should the law apply retroactively or only to disciplinary actions of officers going forward since the bill was enacted? We'll debate that coming right up in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. New law that went into effect this year requiring greater transparency of police officer disciplinary records is under dispute as to whether the law applies retroactively or not. Representatives of police officers' unions say that their members wouldn't have agreed to certain discipline in the past had they known allegations against them would ultimately be made public, that they would have more aggressively fought allegations against them that they thought were unfair. But you have on the other side of that organizations like the ACLU and media organizations that have gone to court to try and get those older disciplinary records released to the public. Now, Southern California Public Radio, which operates KPCC, is a party to a lawsuit along with the Los Angeles Times involving the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. Allegation is that the Sheriff's Department violated the State Public Records Act by not disclosing disciplinary records about two deputies. But stepping back from that specific action, our focus is on how deeply does the law apply? With us from the ACLU of Southern California, Staff Attorney for Criminal Justice and Police Practices, Melanie Ochoa. Ms. Ochoa, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
As you read this law, how do you read it as applying retroactively?
Well, first to clarify, the bill is not retroactive. That's a buzzword that the police unions are trying to use to impose, and it has a very specific legal meaning, and it means that a new law creates some additional legal consequence for a past action, and that is not true here at all. Agencies just have to disclose whatever records they currently have, regardless of when the conduct took place. So if an officer broke the law or violated department policy, he knew he was doing that at the time and did it anyway. He should have received whatever consequence, legally or employment-wise, that he had coming at the time. And while he may prefer that the public remain unaware of that violation, public disclosure is not a legal consequence. So this is not a retroactive law in the first instance. But it was intended clearly by legislatures and the over 150 organizations that supported it to to apply to records of misconduct regardless of when it occurred. If it didn't mean that, then the law would have almost no impact for a very long time if officers could continue to conceal their misconduct.
So just to clarify, your contention, as I'm understanding it, is that whether the disciplinary file is ultimately made public or not is not really legally part of the discipline. It doesn't have any direct legal bearing on what an officer agrees to or the discipline handed out against her or him, that the making it public is just not a legal matter of that.
Exactly. And to be clear, too, this law only applies to very, very serious misconduct. So officers who were found guilty of sexual assault or lying officially or engaging in deadly uses of force. So these are things that could have serious criminal consequences already, civil liability. They could be terminated or reassigned if they're found not credible witnesses in future cases. So there's already very serious consequences that the officers had to consider when they made any decisions as to how they wanted to proceed with their administrative proceedings.
Melanie Ochoa, the ACLU of Southern California staff attorney, also with us, attorney Jacob Kalinske. His firm is representing several law enforcement unions, including the Association for L.A. Deputy Sheriffs, in the lawsuits against AB 1421. Mr. Kalinske, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Do you take issue with how Ms. Ochoa is characterizing retroactivity related to this bill?
I do. So here's the thing. The statute is retroactive because it affects rights retroactively. The way Ms. Ochoa characterized retroactivity has to do with more about ex post facto laws. In other words, laws which have criminal consequences or ascribe, you know, punitive repercussions on activity that happened in the past. But that's not what's required in order for a law to be retroactive. In other words, a retroactive law is one that affects rights going back. And this law, if it is interpreted in the way that the ACLU, for example, is interpreting it, certainly does affect our clients' rights going backwards, because prior to this law, our clients had rights to privacy in these peace officer personnel records. And this right to privacy in personnel records is grounded in the California Constitution. And so, you know, it's one thing to have the law go forward where everybody understands what the concern is going to be, but to apply the law backwards really is unfair, because everybody understood that going, you know, that in the past their records had a certain protection from disclosure. People make they made choices based on those concerns. For example, I'll analogize to the attorney-client privilege, right? If, for example, the legislature passed a new law saying that the attorney-client privilege was no longer valid, then going forward, everyone would understand that communications with their attorneys would not be protected. But it would be tremendously unfair to all of a sudden say, and by the way, all of the communications going in the past that you thought were protected, those aren't going to be protected either. Those
okay.
are now subject to disclosure.
Let me go back to what you said about the right to privacy embedded in the California Constitution. Is there an enumerated right in the Constitution that is directly for law enforcement officer for privacy of disciplinary records that's different than other state employees in California?
Well, so no, the California Constitution essentially gives everybody the right to privacy, right? And so we all have a certain right to personnel records and such. And, you know, through the PCHA statutes and just general common law, there's a notion that, you know, peace officer personnel records, everybody's personnel records had certain protections. For example, you know, in the Pitches case, the Pitches is a set of statutes where, you know, there is a specific process for how an individual in a lawsuit could get a hold of peace officer personnel records under certain circumstances. That's the statute that's been modified by SB 1421. But even in federal litigation or federal actions where there is no PCHA procedure, you still have the same sort of balancing and weighing and understanding that these personnel records, that there's privacy interest
All right.
to them, such they're not going to be disclosed to everyone.
We're talking with Jacob Kalinske. His firm is representing several law enforcement unions, including the Association for L.A. County Deputy Sheriffs. Melanie Ochoa, staff attorney for the ACLU of Southern California, with us. Ms. Ochoa, do you want to respond to Mr. Kalinske's claim that the California Constitution's right to privacy is a protection that was included historically in these disciplinary cases?
Yes, thank you. Just to be clear, officers have no right to privacy in how they interact with the public. All other public employees' records of misconduct are already open to the public under the California Public Records Act. Even under this new law, there's still more secrecy around officer wrongdoing than there is for any other employee. So officers still have privacy in what is truly private, like medical records or home addresses. They just can't continue to conceal the facts of how they sexually assaulted a crime victim or lied under oath in court. And in passing the Right to Know Act, the legislature decided that the public's right to know how officers have violated the public's trust outweighed any preference by the officer to have that remain secret. And there are actually cases specifically rejecting the argument that officers have a right to privacy somehow embedded in the Constitution. They said that's not reasonable to have that expectation.
What about Mr. Kalinske? He brought up this Pitches law that apparently pertains to privacy, which he says was modified as a result of this year's AB 1421. Would not that Pitches statute in some way provide protections for law enforcement officers disciplined?
So the Pitches law allowed the with respect to the PR Public Records Act, it allowed agencies to withhold police officer records. And yes, that law was changed by SB 1421, which is exactly why we're here. So they no longer have that basis for withholding. And under the California Public Records Act, agencies have to produce all relevant public records in their possession unless an exception applies. And so with SB 1421, the Right to Know Act, that exception was taken away. And so that's why they do have to produce those records.
Mr. Kalinske, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, in other words, that's true. That's why this is a retroactive law. In other words, we understood that we had a fundamental right to privacy, and the way that was spelled out was in Pitches. But you see that same sort of analysis outside of Pitches, for example, in the federal common law, and this law has modified that. And we're not arguing. The legislature has spoken about what will be going on in the future, but it's fundamentally unfair to change the game on people who had a certain expectation of privacy based on the state of the law at the time. And you're apparently, the ACLU's position is that it doesn't matter that these people had an expectation of privacy based on what was in the Pitches statutes and what was in other law. That stuff should be produced anyway. And we think that that's fundamentally unfair to take people's assumptions and expectations that were grounded on rights that are enumerated in the Constitution and tell them that it just didn't exist. It didn't matter.
Mr. Kalinske, hold on. Melanie Ochoa, back to you. Where does the case stand and what is it likely to take to ultimately determine whether 1421 applies to previous disciplinary cases?
So there's a number of cases up and down the state. It's basically a coordinated effort by the police unions to try to undermine this bill to finally bring some measure of transparency and accountability to the police. I am involved in the case involving the Police Protective League, which is the LAPD officer union, and I believe both that case and the ALADS case, which Mr. Kalinske is a part of, are going forward on this Friday for oral argument. And there's already been an court in Contra Costa County that rejected the same argument that Mr. Kalinske is putting forward with respect to five different agencies in Northern California. And so we're just hoping that the same result will happen on Friday.
I want to thank you both for being with us. That's Melanie Ochoa, ACLU of Southern California, staff attorney Jacob Kalinske, partner in the firm Raines, Lucia Stern, St. Paul and Silver. They are representing several law enforcement unions, including the Association for L.A. County Deputy Sheriffs. Just once again, KPCC, along with the L.A. Times and the Voice of O.C., has been in a court contending that the police union's claim about retroactivity is improper and counter to the legislature's intent. You're listening to AIR Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, controversy within the West Hollywood City Council involving Mayor John Duran. We'll be back right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. Good morning, it's AIR Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We have major news just in. The Senate has confirmed William Barr as Attorney General. The veteran lawyer who'd been in the position previously will oversee the special counsel's Russia investigation. Again, the Senate has confirmed William Barr as the new U.S. Attorney General. Well, there's plenty of controversy in the city of West Hollywood involving its city council. Three members of the five-member city council are asking that Mayor John Duran of West Hollywood resign. This after three members of the L.A. Gay Men's Chorus claimed that Duran had sexually harassed them. The three members of the council who were calling for the resignation posted almost simultaneously on their Facebook pages. One of them, Lauren Meister, wrote on her page, West Hollywood as a city is suffering as a result of the numerous and repeated allegations against Mayor Duran. I believe that Mayor Duran should do what's best for the city. In this case, it would be to step down from the position of mayor and perhaps step away from the council position so that he can focus on these issues and the city can focus on moving forward. Duran's been the longtime chairman of the board of the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles. Joining us to talk with a bit more detail about the case from Los Angeles Blade news editor Karen Oakham. Karen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for asking me.
So just give us a little bit more of the background here. Three men who were current or former members have alleged that Duran touched them inappropriately.
Well, to say that this is confusing is, you know, an understatement. John Duran says that he did not even know about these latter two accusations that came out in the Los Angeles Times until he read the Los Angeles Times. Two of those people have not yet filed complaints officially with the Gay Men's Chorus, nor apparently did they follow the protocol and procedure of reporting those sexual harassment allegations, which is a procedure put in place so that they could remain anonymous, not have to worry about any sort of pushback from Duran or anybody. But apparently they have not yet filed complaints. They've just publicly stated those complaints to the Times. The other person, Jason Tong, who the LA Times identified as Jason Tong, apparently his complaint was investigated. An independent professional, independent investigator, and what the investigator found was that he was not able to basically verify what his complaint was. Duran asked the investigator, well, I don't know who this person is. When did this supposedly happen? And the investigator said, well, Jason Tong said it happened about 15 minutes before this big, huge concert with the Mexican Gay Men's Chorus. And Duran said, well, wait a second. It was a room filled with about 150 chorus members all changing and getting ready for the concert. I do not remember this man. He provided the names of five men that he had been talking to at that time. as well as other names, attorney Diane Abbott, who was on the board, who handles HR for the Corus, and the Corus, some other names. The investigator went and interviewed those five men, and they said, I don't remember this man either. I don't remember this incident happening. The investigator apparently went back to Jason Tong and said, okay, well, do you have anybody who can speak up for you? And he said no, and ultimately withdrew the complaint. Now, part of the problem with this is that this investigation became part of an HR report, which, as you know, is private. So I could not get my hands on that HR report, and the only way I found out about it was talking to numerous people off the record, on background, and on the record about what they told the investigator. That's how I found out about this. Diane Abbott, who is a longtime attorney and LGBT icon, basically, said that in the 10 years she's been on the board and also serving in HR, she's only known of this one allegation against Duran, and it was dismissed.
All right.
The entire board read the review and took no action. Now, you know the board members have a fiduciary responsibility. So if there was any inkling whatsoever that, you know, some bad action had happened, they would have had to take action. The counterpart to this is that it's being compared to the Me Too movement, where a number of young women in particular are saying, well, wait a second, you know, this has happened to me, and in the face of a powerful man such as the mayor, I too would withdraw my complaint, or I wouldn't pursue it because it wouldn't go anywhere, and the backlash would be on me, which is one of the reasons why there's this great outcry of believe the victims. There's been so much believe the victims when some of the, you know, a majority of the complaints have not been investigated, that there is a counter push now to what about due process.
You know? Karen, hold that thought, because I want to hear from listeners. Karen Oakham is news editor at Los Angeles Blade, and as you can tell, she's been heavily reporting on these allegations involving West Hollywood Mayor John Duran. He's been a frequent guest with us over the years on this program. He's been a leading figure in West Hollywood for many years. Three of his colleagues on the city council have called for him to step down as mayor of West Hollywood in the wake of these claims that the Los Angeles Times has reported on involving three either current or former members of the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles. Duran has been the chairman of the board for many years of that organization. I'd like to hear from you your thoughts about whether you think the three members of the council are correct, that because of the controversy around this, because of the allegations, John Duran should step down as mayor, that would be in the city's best interest, or do you disagree? Do you think that since the allegations have not been corroborated, that John Duran should stand his ground as he is doing at this point and not give up his title as mayor? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We reached out to Mayor Duran, and he was not able to join us today, not able to join us tomorrow as well, and we didn't want to wait to do the segment until when his schedule would allow for it, but we're hearing from two journalists today who've been closely following the story. Again, what do you think, based on what you've heard? Do you agree with the three council members, or do you support the mayor staying on pending further results and public disclosure of what investigations find? 866-893-KPCC. Luke Harold is reporter at Beverly Press. Luke, what's your sense of the local community's response to this?
For the local community, it's a hot-button issue, and it goes back to 3 years ago this month. The city of West Hollywood paid $500,000 to Ian Owens, a former city council deputy who worked under Duran, who accused Duran of sexual harassment. There have been murmurs throughout the community since then about how it reflected on West Hollywood and whether it was appropriate for Duran to continue representing the city. Baran did win re-election in 2017, despite that settlement after those allegations. So this time around, there's been a strong public response as far as Duran at least stepping down as mayor, if not considering resigning. The three council members you mentioned who called for him to step down as mayor last week at a candidate forum, they're up for re-election next month, were non-committal as far as Duran's future as mayor. That was pretty much the extent of the city's reaction until they called for him to step down as mayor on Tuesday. This past Monday, Robert Oliver, the vice chair of the West Hollywood Public Safety Commission, resigned from his post, saying the silence was deafening from the city, and he called for Duran's resignation.
All right. And so, again, I'd love to hear from you as an AirTalk listener. Do you think Duran should give up his title as mayor, stay on the council or not stay on the council? And do you think that, or should he hang on as a result of, you know, the allegations to this point not being corroborated, at least publicly corroborated? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. David in Century City said, I was a resident of West Hollywood, and since when are allegations treated as facts? John Duran needs due process. He should not resign. 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back with in one minute on AirTalk. We're talking about the controversy within the city of West Hollywood and its city council, where a longtime prominent West Hollywood resident leader, John Duran, who's currently mayor of the city, has been asked to step down from the mayor's office by a majority three members of the five-person city council. They've said, as a result of allegations published in the Los Angeles Times, allegations of sexual harassment by Duran against members of the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles, even without there being a resolution to investigation in those cases, that he should step down from his position. Do you agree with the council majority, or do you support the mayor who said he's not going to step down? He denies that he engaged in sexual misconduct or harassment while serving as the chair of the board of directors of the nonprofit Gay Men's Chorus of L.A. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Michael in West Hollywood said, I think the allegations against Duran are more numerous than just the Gay Men's Chorus incident. I have friends who've made complaints against him. There are reports that he's been on Grindr during city council meetings. He should step down. Let me go back to Karen Oakham of Los Angeles Blade news editor. Karen, I recall John Duran in his defense with some of these earlier incidents saying, and I'm paraphrasing, sort of, look, you know, I'm very public about I'm a very sexual person. I make no apologies for who I am, but I do not engage in harassing behavior or abusive behavior. How much does this sort of history, do you think, play into the current issue?
Oh, it plays in a lot, and thank you for raising the point. I mean, it's people need to know that John Duran is a criminal defense attorney, in addition to being the mayor of West Hollywood. He actually, when everybody keeps bringing up this settlement, this $500,000 settlement by the city, but what's not discussed is the fact that Duran and the person who allegedly was offended by John Duran, this Ian Owen, both took the stand, raised their hand, and testified under oath in a trial for Michelle Rex that followed this whole Ian Owen thing, that Duran never touched him, never groped him, never sexually harassed him. What actually had happened was that Ian Owen was under fire for spying on a fellow city council deputy, and he was basically being ushered out the door for that. And on his way out, he said, oh, and Duran sexually harassed me. they investigated that. What it wound up being is that the two of them shared erotic pictures, shall we say. Both of them looked at each other's erotic pictures. That, too, was testified to under oath. So Ian said under oath, John Duran never groped me. John Duran never sexually harassed me. That $500,000 was paid not by the city but by the insurance company, apparently for fear that if they went to trial, the public would not understand the way gay men of a certain generation, you know, are very flirtatious with each other. That, too, plays into the Me Too movement, because what's happening now, and Duran has consistently said, you know, no means no. I mean, he represents victims. So, you know, he said any sexual harassment allegation, this is what he's told me, any sexual harassment allegation needs to be investigated.
I do wonder if there is a generational issue here, just as someone, you know, I grew up in Hollywood in the 70s, and around a lot of gay men, there was a kind of flirtatiousness in play that I often saw, and, you know, sometimes one guy would tell another guy, hey, you know, back off or not. There was stuff that I just don't see today that, you know, decades ago I think was perhaps a bit more common. But, Karen, your thoughts on that. Is there perhaps a generational difference in that John Duran is more outward in his interactions with people and sexual nature than people are comfortable with today?
Yes, I think that's it. And, I mean, Duran comes from the gay liberation generation. I mean, these are the people who survived the AIDS crisis, who invented safer sex, and still, you know, having sexual liberation after so many years of shame and suicide, and it did not get better for them, you know, are kind of defiant about, you know, you do not get to take away my sexual expression. Straight people get to be, you know, flirtatious and touch each other in public all the time. And they're not accused of sexual harassment in this same way. It's not a madman situation. In the workplace, of course, that's very different. And I think that that's where, you know, some discussions are starting to happen. Cross-generational discussions, what exactly constitutes sexual harassment, how do you stand up to power, how do you say no, all these things. It's a crack. It's an opening that's happening, you know, in large part because of the new consciousness of the Me Too movement.
We're talking with Los Angeles Blade News editor Karen Oakham. Larry in West Hollywood says, I know John Duran, and I think the conversation about the call for him to resign has more to do than just these allegations with the Gay Men's Chorus. I think his Grindr posts are aggravating people. He advertises his mayoral status in a sexual context. He is entitled to due process, but he's also making the city look bad, Larry says, and he should know that. West in West Hollywood says, I'm part of Me Too LA, and I'm one of those leading the movement against John Duran, and I don't like that people are apologizing on his behalf. We don't need new allegations to expect him to step down. That's West in West Hollywood. I want to thank journalist Karen Oakham of Los Angeles Blade, Luke Harold of Beverly Press, sharing what they've gleaned from their coverage of the controversy in West Hollywood involving the mayor of the city, John Duran. Three of his colleagues on the council have called in Facebook posts for the mayor to give up his position as mayor, pending public disclosure of investigations into allegations of sexual harassment involving the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We have so much more to come up in the second half, including big news involving Amazon and New York City. Great to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Big news day, so much to get into. A little bit later, we'll talk about Senate passage, overwhelmingly, of the Natural Resources Management Act. It protects all kinds of acreage, 2 million total, much of it in California, extending the range of protected lands in the Mojave Desert, adjacent to national parks. We'll talk about what the impact is and also what local jurisdictions think of greater federal control over those lands. But first, the bombshell from Amazon this morning, abruptly announcing it's pulling the plug on a big new second headquarters in New York City. Amazon had touted 25,000 jobs that would have been created within New York City after a year-long process setting cities against each other to compete for what kinds of subsidies or enhancements they would provide to Amazon for locating within their communities. Amazon said in a blog post, "We are disappointed to have reached this conclusion. We love New York." Company saying it already has 5,000 employees in the city and will still increase. But it's a huge setback for the governor of New York and the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, as there'd been intense lobbying for this second Amazon headquarters. With us is City Hall reporter for the New York Times, J. David Goodman. David, thank you for joining us. Did the city get any forewarning that Amazon was pulling out?
Well, we're still reporting this story, but so far as I know now, they got very, very little warning that the decision had been made. And as you probably know, and your listeners may know, there'd been a lot of grumbling in recent weeks, and especially in recent days among folks at Amazon over the reception that they got here in New York, that they felt like they weren't being welcomed, and they were seeing that the path to them getting this project approved was going to be bumpier than they had anticipated. But as I understand it, the mayor and the governor found out only shortly before the rest of the world did that this deal that they spent more than a year and then in intense negotiations for weeks to secure had fallen apart.
And where was the major opposition to the Amazon New York City location? Where was that opposition coming from?
It's interesting. What happened in New York was when the Amazon first said they're going to look for a new headquarters, New York City looked a particular way politically. The area of Queens had a strong, what people believe to be a strong county organization, and it had a state Senate in the hands of Republicans. And so the governor had an ability, for complicated reasons, to get his make decisions and get his will in Albany. And in the span of a few months, starting with the election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and then with the state Senate flipping, you actually had the political landscape completely shift under the ground of Amazon. So by the time they announce that they're coming to New York in November, you have a representative in Washington who's quite popular and powerful in Ocasio-Cortez, who's against this deal. But almost more consequentially, you have state senators who are willing to appoint a vocal critic and opponent of the deal to the very board that had the power to block it when it came before it. And so suddenly what was meant to be a smooth path forward and one that the mayor and the governor had constructed for Amazon was completely uncertain.
I don't know when the most recent polling was done of New Yorkers, but I know there was a Quinnipiac University poll in December, which showed 57% of New York City voters favored the Amazon headquarters in Queens. Only 26% were opposed. The question was asked about whether they favored the nearly $3 billion in tax incentives, and that was split down the middle, statistically insignificant difference. So you see how divided this city was on the incentives. Is there anything more recent than that you're aware of, David?
Yeah, no, there was a poll that went out just in the last few days from Siena College, and they were polling a bunch of different issues in New York State. But one of the questions they asked was a very direct question of, you know, do you support giving Amazon something like $3 billion in you know, incentives and subsidies in exchange for having them create 25 to 40,000 jobs? And so it's very direct, you know, do you approve of this deal? And by wide margins across all groups, New Yorkers and New York State voters did approve. And so there was a feeling in among Amazon supporters that the momentum was kind of shifting their way, that you had a series of polls that weren't moving against them.
and you had some signs that maybe supporters were getting a little bit of their legs under them, and then this happens.
What is the potential political fallout, if any, to Mayor de Blasio and to Governor Cuomo after this?
Well, that's an open question. I mean, it's interesting what it says for Governor Cuomo. It's very different, actually, for the two of them. And for Governor Cuomo, this is a real blow because this is a deal that not only did he own with the mayor in announcing it, but it's something that he owned publicly since. And he was engaging in open warfare with the state Democratic conference in the last few days to try and get this thing through. And so what it shows is that he doesn't have the power to exert his will in Albany as he's enjoyed for his first two terms. He's now embarking on a third term. And so that's a major blow to him and may cause him many other problems down the road. For Mayor de Blasio, in a way, this was a blessing in disguise if his goal is to appear more progressive to a national audience. Now, he is associated with having supported it, but he wasn't as much the public face. And his messaging right after, he had a statement essentially, you know, saying that don't let the door hit you on the way out. I mean, he didn't say that exactly, but that was the sentiment that suddenly he's saying, you know, if they can't, you know, take the heat, you know, they can't take New York. And so he was trying to sort of flip and be more on the side of the progressives with whom he really identifies and is trying to lead nationally. Amazon was a problem for him, and this has sort of been taken away.
What was the progressive critique? Was it just about, $3 billion, a lot of subsidy, but was it solely about the subsidy, or were there other issues of having Amazon come into Queens the progressives were against?
There was the critique of gentrification, that essentially this by constructing this office complex in Queens, you were going to gentrify much more rapidly an area of Queens that had, you know, not been sort of gentrifying that quickly. It would increase housing prices, force displace, you know, low-income New Yorkers, and that it was bad for those reasons. There was another critique that wasn't about Queens at all and was about the company, and that said, you know, this is a company that works with immigration enforcement, that is anti-union, and that doesn't belong in New York City. And if we're going to take a stand, we should take a stand here. And these activists felt very emboldened. They had taken down, in electing Ocasio-Cortez or helping get her elected, they had taken down the county leadership, as I said before, which was reputed to be very powerful. And they were able to stand up to that. Amazon was the next sort of scalp, and they were able to go after Amazon now. And so they feel, I think, even more powerful than they did before. And I think for all elected leaders in New York City, you haven't seen criticism of those who have stood in Amazon's way and sort of killed this deal. You've seen almost, letters of support from the mayor and from others here.
And is there any plan B for the property that was going to be developed for Amazon in Queens, or is that now just open for future development?
It's interesting. I mean, it's too soon to say what's going to happen there. There was a plan to redevelop that area prior to Amazon coming in, and they essentially scrapped that plan to do this. And so whether they go back to that, I don't know. I mean, there is neighborhood resistance to building bigger there now. So do they build bigger? Do they wait to let this calm down? But there is still a housing need in New York City. And, you know, I could imagine some plan that builds affordable housing in the place and has some mixed use for commercial there, but is not as focused on office space. But we really need to wait and see what the city thinks it can get through there and not get bogged down in the same opposition once again.
David, thank you so much. Really appreciate your giving us all the detail on Amazon's surprise decision to pull out of putting its second headquarters in New York City. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
A New York Times City Hall reporter J. David Goodman with us on Air Talk. To give us a little bit broader context about what comes next for Amazon with this announcement, from Bloomberg, editor based in San Francisco, Alastair Barr. Alastair, thank you very much for joining us. Did folks in the tech community see this coming?
No, they didn't at all. I think the main expectation was that Amazon would continue to negotiate, and it's a great deal for Amazon. It was a great deal for Amazon, and so they expected them to, you know, push forward and maybe be more forthcoming about what the company was going to do to engage in things like job training and other community efforts for the residents in that specific area. So, shocked this morning for sure.
And I know this you know, just happened a couple of hours ago, but did Amazon disclose what its plans are for expansion now, or if there will be a secondary headquarters somewhere else?
So they are going to expand a small location, relatively small location in Nashville, and then there's also one in Northern Virginia, which is roughly the same size as the one that they are planning in New York City. So originally, you know, the HQ2, as it was called, project was going to be for 50,000 people, 50,000 employees over a couple of decades, and now they were going to split that between New York and Northern Virginia. So Northern Virginia goes ahead, Nashville will go ahead too. We did some double checking, and we're told that this is not another hardball negotiating tactic, and they have walked away from the New York deal. We thought maybe it was an extreme negotiating tactic, but unfortunately not.
Well, interesting, because those other two locations of Nashville and Northern Virginia, I think of more conservative communities than, of course, New York City. And is that potentially something that Amazon, I wonder, or other tech companies are going to be looking at, being a little wary of going into places that are progressive strongholds?
Well, I think practically speaking, the Northern Virginia location is I think a lot easier. That actual area is a bit of a ghost town, and there's lots of commercial real estate waiting to be used there. And I think the people who live in that area are less concerned about gentrification and congestion and costs rising. So that was a more practical concern. But yeah, your broader point is very valid, and I think what this shows is that there's a lot of popular distrust of the big five U.S. tech companies that are out there, Amazon obviously being among the largest of those. You know, people trust Amazon to deliver their packages in 2 days. But when they start thinking about, you know, how are those packages delivered, how are people treated in the warehouses, you know, is actually a good idea that Amazon, you know, will control a lot of the commerce that's going on online in the world. You know, people have different views about it. And I think in New York, I think there was certainly a sentiment among progressives that Amazon wasn't the type of company that they wanted to give $3 billion in incentives to.
Now, Google, I understand, is investing about $1 billion into New York City headquarters. Might Amazon's decision have any effect on what Google does there?
Well, I'm sure it's actually, relatively speaking, it's great for Google, because one of the cruxes of the Amazon debate in New York City was this issue of job creation, 25,000 jobs coming over a couple of decades. You know, you can get those jobs by pulling people from across the U.S., pulling people from across the world, and moving them to Long Island City, right? And not helping the people who live in that area. Or you can spend a lot of time training people in that area, bringing them up, raising the tax base, and really helping the people who live there. And you know, the part of the concern for a company like Google was just going to be Amazon was going to arrive in Long Island City and hire away half the people who work at Google, who are already getting paid a lot, who are already paying a lot of taxes. And, you know, maybe they'll pay them $20,000 more a year and they'll just jump over to Long Island City to work. And so that I think it's probably, you know, on the margin, a relief for Google in New York City. And, you know, but it is quite telling with regards to that debate about how those Amazon jobs were going to be created.
Alistair, before I let you go, you think that it's likely Amazon is going to go back into a process of competition for a second headquarters? Or do you think maybe this is part of the decision that they don't need that after all?
I certainly think they might look back and regret the whole process. But, you know, us in the media, you know, were whipped along by this idea that there was going to be a huge, you know, new headquarters with 50,000 people. We wrote about it a lot. All these cities, you know, competed. I think, you know, that actually caused a lot of scrutiny when the deals were actually done, which Amazon, you know, doesn't like and probably regrets now. So I imagine what they're going to do is they're going to keep recruiting in New York City because there's so many talented people there, and they're just not going to make a huge song and dance about it and you go after billions of dollars in incentives direct, you know, out in the open anyway.
Alistair Barr, Bloomberg editor, thank you very much. Appreciate your talking with us about the larger picture involved in Amazon's surprise announcement this morning that they are not going to develop what they called HQ2, a secondary headquarters in New York City's Queens Borough. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll talk about a huge bill in the Senate that was passed Tuesday, expanding federal land protections, most of it in the American West. It's Air Talk on KPCC, back in just 1 minute. Coming up later this hour on Air Talk, we'll be joined by a psychologist who wrote a very interesting piece in the New York Times recently, arguing that the traits that serve girls on average so well in school might not be so beneficial in the workplace. We'll hear her theory coming up a little bit later right here on KPCC. But first, a big win for conservationists as the U.S. Senate on Tuesday approved a major public lands bill, which includes additional protections for millions of acres, including in the Mojave Desert area of California, adjacent to national parks like Joshua Tree. Joining us to talk about the significance of this bill that is expected to pass the House and will likely be signed by the president is David Lanfram, director of the California Desert and National Wildlife Programs of the National Parks Conservation Association. David, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you again, Larry.
So let's start first of all with, you know, what were there compromises that actually led this to finally get passed?
Well, it's a great question, and you know, the thing to be thinking about is that there hadn't been comprehensive legislation for conservation passed in a pretty long time, and so there was a really significant backlog of issues all across our great nation, and so. Well, I think part of it was that there was inertia and momentum to get this done, and we saw that through the result, which was a vote of 92-8, which is really an astonishing and really significant passage through the Senate.
David Lanfram of the National Parks Conservation Association conversing with us, and Don Rao, who is supervisor representing San Bernardino County's 3rd District. Thank you very much, Supervisor Rao, for being with us. What effect do you see this having on your county?
I'm excited about the bill moving forward. There's two aspects. There's a conservation aspect that I'm sure David will be able to fill you in on more in the limited time that I have. I am exceptionally excited about the off-road and recreation provisions that there are in the bill, and I can talk to those. And then we also have a neat part that's a land exchange that's taking place down here in the Highlands area with the Santa Ana Land Wash Exchange. It's also a very neat aspect for both business and conservation.
So let's talk about the recreational off-roading. I know is a big part of that Mojave Desert area of your county. So what is the expansion of rec there?
So there's two things as far as OHV goes, the off-road vehicle provisions. BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, currently has the rights to administer that from their level. And this bill actually congressionally designates, it gives that a status that it makes it into an OHV area that's a congressional designation. So that means anything that's going to be undone or changed takes place at a congressional level. So that adds additional protections, which we're really excited about. And then in addition, and that's in 5 areas. We have Spangler Hills, Dumont Dunes, Razor, El Mirage, and Stoddard Valley that will all be changed from administrative to congressionally designated. And then the most exciting part for me is that it adds 61,000 additional OHV acres, and 20 of those, 20,000, a little over 20,000, are specific to the Johnson Valley off-highway vehicle area that's sort of right in my backyard.
And is it your excitement for your constituents, or are you an off-road user yourself?
Both of those.
All right. And you mentioned a land swap above Highland, was it? What's involved?
It's the Santa Ana Land Wash Exchange, and it is something that Senator Feinstein was instrumental in helping move forward and in having included in this bill as it moves. And Congressman Cook also, with the help of Congressman Aguilar. And what it is it's 327 acres of BLM land that's going to be exchanged with about 310 acres of the San Bernardino Water Conservation District. And it's the swap that's taking place basically allows, we have Cemex and Robertson's Ready Mix that do mining operations where they're looking to get aggregate out. And they have adjacent land that's in an area that has threatened and endangered species on it. And this land swap between the two agencies will allow for the mining operations to continue and then that critical habitat to remain intact so that our threatened and endangered species will be allowed to thrive.
All right. And you're not concerned about additional federal control over these lands adjacent to your or in your county?
With regard to what aspect?
Well, I don't know. Just whether I know historically there have been concerns about as there's expansion of federal lands in San Bernardino County, that encroaches on the ability of San Bernardinians to be able to decide what they want to do with some of that property.
Well, so that's a great question. About 80% of our land in San Bernardino County is already owned by the federal government. And so some of these designations that I mentioned earlier, the Bureau of Land Management administers already those areas for recreation. It's just really adding a protection to the existing uses that are there. And when it comes to adding lands, for example, into Joshua Tree National Park, that's exciting to me because that adds to the value of the recreation that we all enjoy up in the Morongo Basin and on the Coachella Valley side. And those lands weren't in public land. They were held by the Mojave Desert Land Trust, some of them. And they were donated to the park. And so this just makes the park bigger and better for recreation. And I really think it streamlines how it's administered, and it allows the superintendent of that national park to be able to do a more effective job in the land management side.
Supervisor Rao, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate you sharing a local perspective on this Senate-passed measure. We appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
Thank you. Don Rao represents San Bernardino County's 3rd District communities like Joshua Tree, Johnson Valley, Lucerne Valley, as well as the cities of Redlands, Yucaipa, Loma Linda, 29 Palms, Yucca Valley are within her district. Also with us, David Lamprum, director of the California Desert and National Wildlife Programs at the National Parks Conservation Association. You have any concerns about the expansion of off-road vehicle usage in this area?
Well, Larry, thank you for the question. You know, the reality is that our community, the environmental community, worked closely with the off-highway vehicle community to try to bring some common sense management to the California desert. So we worked to both, create new national monuments, to expand wilderness designations, to create wild and scenic rivers, to expand our national parks, but also to make sure that folks who ride OHVs had a place where they could do that responsibly and not have to worry about trespassing. So millions of people in Southern California recreate using off-highway vehicles, and so ultimately we need to make sure that they have a place to ride. Otherwise, there's problems like incursion and trespass, and we want to work in partnership and avoid those problems. We want to be proactive about that.
Now, what about restoration of Route 66 through this area of the Mojave? I know there was debate about would bridge construction be allowed because of federal protections. What's the upshot of that debate?
Well, it's that issue is a pretty sticky issue, but the opportunity is profound. So within Mojave Trails National Monument is the longest continuous stretch of Route 66 remaining in the country. And so it's also, because of the high mountains in that region, an area that's very, very prone to being washed out due to flash floods. And so the timbers that those bridges are constructed of are actually historic. And so the county and the feds, Caltrans, et cetera, have all been trying to work on a solution to build better bridges and to do that in a way that is reasonable and allows and protects the people, because the reality is with the creation of Mojave Trails National Monument, our expectation is that a lot more people are going to be visiting this area, and we've already seen that start.
And finally, when it comes to habitat protection, are there particular species that you can point to that you think benefit by this expansion?
Well, there are some, thank you for asking that question, and the answer is absolutely. And the California desert, for people who don't know, it's it's a wonderland for wildlife. And, you know, it's a place where there are desert bighorn sheep and mountain lions and golden eagles. It's an area where we're looking to reintroduce the pronghorn antelope. It's a very, very rich area. And so all of those species are going to benefit, but especially the desert tortoise. The conservation that we hope will happen when Congress passes this legislation is going to mean that there's going to be connectivity and habitat for so many of these species: desert tortoise, bighorn sheep, gray foxes, kit foxes, badgers. It's really fantastic. And one other thing I would just say is that when I'm looking big picture at what this conservation means, when you're taking a look at the map of the California desert, people are starting to recognize it's one of the most remarkable protected landscapes in the lower 48, and people from all over the world are coming here. And what the creation of the wilderness areas and the expansion of Death Valley National Park do is basically help create a corridor of conservation between Mojave National Preserve and Death Valley National Park, and that's globally significant. We have, I think, in partnership with communities and the people who really care about the California desert, been able to do a pretty good job of protecting what is a really special place. And people will be coming here forever to experience and enjoy that.
I love that you brought up the global significance of this, because the time that I spend in the Mojave, I'm always struck by how many Europeans and Japanese tourists will come and in many ways appreciate this local treasure, maybe even more than those of us that are born and raised nearby. And it is globally significant. I'm very glad that you brought that up. David, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure to be with you, sir.
Thank you. Director of California Desert and National Wildlife Programs for the National Parks Conservation Association. Joining us from Barstow, David Lamfrum. Again, that passed 98-2 in the U.S. Senate, one of those rare, remarkable bipartisan moments in Congress. It moves to the House of Representatives, where passage is expected for the Natural Resources Management Act. Dianne Feinstein, California senior senator with a prominent role in shepherding this through, President Trump is expected to sign the bill. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I sure hope to see you this Sunday. I'll be on stage with our critics for the 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview, 1 o'clock at the Theater at Ace Hotel downtown on Broadway. Beautiful historic movie theater. Clips of all the Oscar-nominated films. Every year I look forward to this so much. Something about seeing the clips of those movies on that massive screen. I sure hope that you're there to be part of the experience. Tickets are limited but still available at kpecc.org/in-person. It's going to be a big crowd there Sunday afternoon. Our critics sure look forward to it as I do, and I sure hope to see you there. I'll be back as we take a look at that essay I was telling you about earlier from the New York Times, psychologist with a very interesting theory about how things that benefit girls in school may often be a hindrance in the workplace. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Longtime listener Norma making me laugh with her posting on the Air Talk page. Going into this next segment, she says, I'm ready to slam down this theory, but I guess I'll listen first. That's Norma posting on the Air Talk page. Well, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. This op-ed piece in the New York Times actually fodder for a lengthy conversation I had with my high school senior son about his perceptions of the thesis that's laid out by our guest, Shaker Heights, Ohio-based psychologist Lisa Damore. She's author of the piece in the New York Times, Why Girls Beat Boys at School and Lose to Them at the Office. Her brand new book that's just out is titled Under Pressure, Confronting the Epidemic of Stress and Anxiety in Girls. Lisa Damore, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So just sort of lay out the thesis of the New York Times piece. You can elaborate on it, but it seems what you're arguing is that girls often outperform boys in school. They outperform them academically because of certain traits that they on average exhibit. But when those same traits are applied in the workforce, they're not rewarded in the same way. Is that an accurate characterization?
I think that that's the rough shape of it.
And so elaborate a bit on it. How did these traits that girls on average exhibit at school, how are those reinforced or rewarded?
So here's what we know from the research. Girls are, as a group, right? So we're talking broad strokes. So this does not apply to every girl, and the opposite does not apply to every boy. But when we look at the broad strokes of gender research, what we see is that girls consistently outperform boys academically. They are getting better grades pretty much from the moment they step into a school. They're graduating at higher rates. They're more likely to be valedictorians. They're going to college at higher rates. They're graduating from there at higher rates. So girls are doing extraordinarily well academically. And then we also notice that in major corporations, they do not hold very many leadership positions. So one of the things I started to observe in my work as a psychologist is that for a lot of girls, school is a place where they are very stressed, in part for some of them because they are hyper-conscientious. They do incredibly good work. And in fact, they often do more than is asked of them at school. And this is something I've observed both clinically, and then I spend a lot of my time working in schools and talking to educators. And one of the things that when you talk with people in co-ed settings and parents of girls and boys, it is not at all unusual for parents to say, oh, yes, yes, my daughter, she's so conscientious. The teacher will assign 20 flashcards and she'll make 40. And oh, my son, you know, he's doing the least amount he thinks he has to do to keep the adults off his back. You know, those kinds of gendered tropes do emerge. And again, they don't apply to all kids everywhere, but you do see these patterns sort of be discussed and recognized by parents and educators. So I was talking about this. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and then how's that work in the workplace?
Well, so I was talking about this with a group of parents, and afterwards a mom came up to me, and she is someone who's worked in the corporate world for a long time, and she said, you know, I see the same thing at my office. I see these women who are so hardworking and doing 110%, and they are not getting as far as the men who do less but have a lot more confidence in their own abilities. And so then I started to wonder if there were some dots here that we needed to connect. If there was any possibility that girls only develop confidence in their work ethic, but not in their wits and their capacities, because they don't really test those. They rely so heavily as a group on their work ethic. And that took me to the work of Caddy Kay and Claire Shipman, who have written a book called The Confidence Code, which is excellent, about various barriers to women at work. And their conclusion in that book is that confidence is a huge factor in professional success, and that women arrive in the workplace with less of it than men.
We're talking with psychologist Lisa DeMoor. She's based in Shaker Heights, Ohio. Her brand new book, Under Pressure, Confronting the Epidemic of Stress and Anxiety in Girls. I welcome your thoughts. What do you think about her points about the different ways on average, and being very clear, these are broad strokes. It's not, you know, there are all kinds of boys who exhibit what she's talking about. Girls on average overrepresent and vice versa. But that on average, you see gender differences in how boys and girls approach school, and that often the ways in which girls are approaching school, this sort of hyper-conscientiousness, is not helping them, in fact, is hurting them in the workplace. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. In that conversation with my son that I referenced, because he largely agreed with your thesis, Lisa, but he added he thought one of the reasons for the difference in confidence, his perception was that with girls in high school, they see the success in school as largely a result of environment. What are the circumstances in which they're raised? And then the degree of effort that they put into it. There's not really much credit that's given to inborn skill or intelligence. And my son was saying his perception is that among the boys on average, there's much more of this feeling like, yeah, I'm sharp, I have this skill, and it can be developed, or it can be, but kind of a sense of confidence in inborn ability. And I was wondering, is that something that you've come across, that sort of difference in perception?
Yes, that's exactly my point. And I'm completely in agreement with your son that the way boys do school may help them develop a sense of, hey, you know, I can kind of wing it. And then I do well, which means I have real skills. And then we have girls who are just as capable as the boys who never wing it. And so they never discover what they could do if they hardly try, because they never hardly try.
What is, if there needs to be a fix for this, to develop more confidence in girls' innate ability, what's the answer to that?
So here's what I think we need to do. We need to maybe walk back our praise of girls' overwork strategies and start to ask more questions of girls when they are overworking. So, for example, it is not uncommon for girls who have a high A average in a class to be turning in extra credit on top of that. And I think that we have defaulted to saying, oh, look at how hard they work. They're amazing. And they are. I think at this point, we need to start to say to them, talk to me about why you're turning in extra credit when you already have an A and a lot of mastery. If the girl says, I adore this class, the subject is fabulous, then, you know, more power to her. But if she says, well, I want insurance points just to be sure, I would love to have the teacher say to her, you have a lot more mastery than you are giving yourself credit for. And I bet there are other things you could be doing with this time, maybe getting more rest or enjoying yourself more or getting more sleep and working on classes where you don't have the same grade that you want.
We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. I also wonder about compliance coming into this, culturally reinforced or otherwise. You know, my perception when I was in school was that when I would challenge a contention of a teacher or come at something with a different point of view, which I did a lot when I was in school, that the girls were made very uncomfortable by that, even though I was respectful. But the idea that I would question the authority was somehow, and girls, in my experience, comparatively rarely did that. And my son reports that even among his age group, it's much more common for the boys to sort of, you know, come back with something that might be challenging. And I wonder, is that something that has been quantified?
It is. Your observations are supported by the research. When we look again in broad gender strokes, girls are more worried about disappointing adults and they are very attuned to adult approval. So when we are approving a girl turning in 40 flashcards when she only needed to do 20, we are reinforcing that behavior. We can also use our approval to help her become more tactical about school. So an adult who says, look, you should take a sample test before you start studying. You know, I say this to girls often, so that you figure out exactly what you already know and you don't need to study those things anymore, and then put your energies towards the material that you still need to learn. And adults, you know, when we actively reward and reinforce and admire those tactical skills, girls respond to that, and it means that their stress goes down. For me, the driver is that girls are also much more stressed by school, even while they are doing really well. And I'm concerned about stress in girls, and I'm concerned about how little sleep they get. And school is a major part of that, and they are, as a group, pretty inefficient.
Would you support parents encouraging their girls, if their girls maybe question something in class or to be more challenging, to be more, not so cautious necessarily in the classroom about coming back with something that they disagree with?
This is a great question and a very complex issue. And one of the things that advocates for girls and young women think about a lot, and also adult women, is how females present themselves. And there is a strong press for us to ask girls and young women to be more forthright, more bold, more, pointed in their presentation of their views. And we worry that they say, you know, oh, I'm sorry, or do you mind, or would it be okay? You know, what linguists call that hedging, you know, sort of softening their communications. So it's very well-meaning to encourage them to be forthright. And I think there are a lot of contexts in which that makes sense. When we look at the research, though, girls being forthright is not received in the same way that boys being forthright is. So we are certainly within, you know, there's good reason to encourage it, but we want to be careful because we should not encourage it and suggest to the girl that she's going to get the same reaction as the boy.
Yeah, so sort of prepare that it may not be met equitably in the response and maybe strategies for dealing with that. We'll continue our conversation with psychologist Lisa Damore. She's based in Ohio and author of the new book, Under Pressure, Confronting the Epidemic of Stress and Anxiety in Girls, author of the recent New York Times op-ed, Why Girls Beat Boys at School and Lose to Them at the Office. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Kimmy tweets to Air Talk, I went to an all-girls high school, and in retrospect, we were all working harder, not smarter. Every day at school, I witnessed girls comparing how late they stayed up, how many all-nighters they did that week. It was hard to live up to those standards we set. That's Kimmy tweeting us at Air Talk. Let me take a listener call from Laura in Burbank. Laura, I understand you work in the visual effects industry. How do you see this playing out in your work?
Well, I watch women get docked for confidence. Confidence is perceived as arrogance, and women are much more scrutinized on that. And discrimination, harassment, all these things that are so much in the public limelight now, they relate very much to female confidence, and confidence can be punished.
It's a little hard to understand you, Laura. We have a bad connection, or you're a little muffled, but I think you were saying, in your industry at least, both men and women punish the confidence that women show. So it's not women don't start out with confidence. They do, I think you were saying. But there's punishment for exhibiting that. Psychologist Lisa Damore, you want to respond to that?
I think that what Laura is describing is absolutely true, that men and women are not reacted to in the same ways when they are, as we were just sort of saying, bold or forthright or, you know, really putting their opinions forward in assertive ways. This is something we need to deal with at the cultural level and that we need to grapple with as a society. The answer, though, is not to not cultivate girls' confidence. We do want confident young women, and we do want them to enter the workplace with a belief in their abilities and their work ethics. And so if we can do both, we can try to hit it from both sides, both cultivating confident girls and then challenging the ways in which the culture punishes them unfairly.
Colleen in Los Alamitos asked whether you see a difference between girls educated in all-girls schools versus co-ed. Colleen says she went to an all-girls K through 12, and she thinks that girls like her from that educational environment are more assertive.
So this is something we've tried to study, and in truth, we have not been able to do the kinds of studies we like to, because to do good studies on this, you have to randomly assign people to their conditions, whether they be all girls or co-ed, and you can't randomly do it. But anecdotally, you hear this a lot, that all girls schools do cultivate a sense of confidence, and the argument that all girls schools make, and this is a very fair argument, is that the boys take up a lot of airtime in a classroom, and there is evidence for that. And so it sort of turns into a zero-sum game. When the boys are talking, the girls can't be talking. In an all-girls environment, it's always the girls talking.
Let's talk with Jennifer in Glendale. Jennifer, you're on with psychologist Lisa Damore.
Hey, good morning. Interestingly, at work, I'm in law enforcement. I just got a recent promotion, and my male counterparts don't appear to be doing as good or as thorough a job as I am, but they brag a lot about how well they're doing and what a great job they're doing. I've started doing the same thing, and it's working for me in spades.
Jennifer,
congratulations
on your promotion. I love that because Jennifer raises a point that, you know, we all notice in the workplace. There's certain people who work with a great deal of flamboyance, and you always know how much they're doing, whether it's bragging, as she's describing, or just outward gestures of how hard the person works, versus others who are just very quietly, nose to the grindstone. So your thoughts about Jennifer's comment?
Well, it's just such a good example of how much this is context driven, Right. So we have Laura in one industry saying it doesn't work well for women to be confident. And then we have Jennifer in another industry saying it's working great for me. So it gives me hope that there is room for confident women to succeed. But we have to get more confident women into the workplace. And I think there are some adjustments we might be able to make in how we talk with girls about school that might help them cultivate more of that confidence.
Now, I've had a couple of people, Lisa, who have said, well, really, boys need to be more like girls. They need to, you know, do this more intense focus on education, that would be positive. Your response to that?
That is true. Boys are underperforming academically, and that is something that needs to be addressed. And it would probably be better if everyone sort of met in the middle, maybe, where if boys as a group upped their conscientiousness and maybe girls were a little more tactical. But here's the rub. We have made a habit of sort of denigrating how boys do school. And I want us to just pause on that, because one friend of mine, she has three sons, and she said, oh, and these were all boys who did extremely well academically. She said, oh, they perfected the 89.5. They would get themselves the lowest grade possible in order to get an A in a class. And while we can kind of wrinkle our nose at that, here's where we are as a culture. For very ambitious students, students who are applying to very high-level colleges, they are on average taking 8 APs in high school and as many as 13. The boys who have figured out how to get an 89.5 are the ones who will be able to sustain that level academically through high school. Girls who, as a group, are doing quite a bit more, I see them over and over again taking the same intensive academic program and being crushed by it while getting the same grade as the boys in the end.
I think there's another factor which we can't even begin to get into at any depth because of time, but how education itself, the way that it's conducted within the classroom, there are those that believe that just the format of that advantages girls over boys, and that it is more difficult for boys to learn in that kind of traditional classroom setting. You have an opinion on that?
There's a lot of truth to that. It starts in kindergarten, and what we know is that there are not actually a lot of ingrained biological differences at the mental level between boys and girls. But one thing that we do see that plays a role from the day they walk into the kindergarten classroom is that girls develop their small motor skills first, while boys develop large motor skills. Small motor skills make it easy for you to hold a pencil and to articulate words. So school is built for girls.
Lisa DeMore, thank you so much. Time's gone too fast, but it's been very interesting talking with you about this. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Lisa DeMore, Shaker Heights, Ohio-based psychologist. Her brand new book, Under Pressure, Confronting the Epidemic of Stress and Anxiety in Girls, and her recent op-ed piece in the New York Times titled Why Girls Beat Boys in School and Lose to Them at the Office. Have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. I'll be back with you tomorrow, 10 o'clock with Air Talk, 11 o'clock. It's Film Week, big week in movies, right here on KPCC.